Yes. Okay, so I would like to thank the organizers for inviting me and to give a talk. And the conference is great. I'm really enjoying it. So my talk is listed as an overview of non-relativistic theories. So of course, I'm not qualified to give a review of all non-relativistic theories. So what I'm qualified to do is to give an overview of my approach to non-relativistic theories. Okay? And I should say that over the years, I've gathered a large cloud of collaborators here. And most of what I'm going to say was derived in collaboration with some of these people. And I'm sure you recognize many names here. And we published a number of papers, and there's more coming out soon. So my approach to non-relativistic theories has been essentially to make them relativistic, okay? In a sense that will become clear in a second. So usually when we talk about condensed matter, we give up relativity, okay? We say, okay, condensed matter, we build an effective field theory for some condensed matter system, there's no relativity. And the reason is twofold. There's the statement that in the lab, for instance, you have stress tensors, pressures that are very non-relativistic, so much smaller than, for instance, the mass density. You have propagation speeds, like the speed of sound, which are much smaller than the speed of light. Okay. And but there's a more fundamental reason, which is more important, if you want, which is that a condensed matter system, perhaps by definition, picks a frame. Okay. Once you have a medium, there is a preferred rest frame for the medium. And so excitations of this system, for instance, perceive that preferred frame, okay? By the way, I should say that whenever I talk about relativity, I mean both Lorentz and Galilei, okay? Meaning that the Galilei relativity is as relativistic as Lorentz. It's only missing V over C square effects, but the amount of symmetries is the same, okay? So the Galilei boosts are as powerful for constraining the dynamics as the Lorentz symmetry. So in particular, when we talk about very small speeds, et cetera, one is tempted to talk about Galilei invariance, okay? So that's perfectly fine. So in this sense, this first reason is not really a good reason to give up relativity, okay? One could simply say, okay, let me use the approximation of Lorentz that I call Galilei relativity, but it's still a relativistic system. So this is really the fundamental reason why we don't talk about relativity in condensed matter systems. But of course, it's the medium that is speaking the frame, okay? So in this sense, relativity is always spontaneously broken. So as far as we know, the fundamental physics of the universe is Lorentz invariant, and whatever breaking we might have of Lorentz invariance is always spontaneous, okay? So in a sense, relativity is there. It's not linearly realized by the excitations of the system, okay? And so in many approaches to condensed matter effective field theories, you just neglect this fact because maybe you are not interested in keeping track of the phonons. Okay, the phonons are going to be, in general, the Goldstone bosons associated with spontaneous breaking of boosts. But in other situations, the phonons are important. Okay, so our approach has been to actually insist on the phonons. And in fact, whatever I'm going to do today only has to do with these Goldstone excitations. So I'm always going to talk about the Goldstone excitations associated with spontaneous breaking of boosts and other space-time symmetries. In particular, I'm going, yes?
Just interrupt. I mean, many effective condensed
matter theories are not listed with the speed of light replaced by the speed of sound. But that's typically a lowest order statement, no? Meaning, for instance, you look at the quadratic dispersion, at the dispersion relation for some excitations, you notice that it's linear. And so you say, ah, look, it looks like a relativistic dispersion relation with the speed of sound replaced by the speed of light. But suppose, for instance, you take a solid, now you have longitudinal phonons and transverse phonons. They have two different propagation speeds. There's no Lorentz invariance there.
Yeah, but all the
They are, sorry?
You look at the low energy behavior.
Yes. That's fine. I mean, as long as you, let's say, truncate the dynamics to the level and at which the dynamics is relative, is apparently relativistic in your sense, I think that's perfectly fine. I guess what I'm insisting here on is the fact that truly relativistic effects are always there if you look close enough, okay? So for instance, let me give you an example. If you look at the dynamics of phonons in a solid, if you don't take into account the fact that the phonons non-linearly realize Lorentz, or Galilei for that matter, you write down more interactions than you are allowed to write down when you impose non-linearly realized Galilei. So by looking at, if you want, phonon-phonon scattering amplitudes, you can detect that the phonons non-linearly realize Galilei or Lorentz. That's what I'm talking about. I agree with you. In certain situations, there might be other formal relativistic. No. I'm not talking about, once again, I'm not talking about V over C square effects. Okay? These are there for Lorentz invariants, and they're not there for Galilei invariants. I'm saying that even for a Galilei invariant limit of Lorentz invariants, the fact that the Goldstones non-linearly realize the symmetry constrains crucially the interactions. So I'm saying that the leading scattering amplitudes have this property. Everything. So these are going to be Goldstones for all the spacetime symmetries. Well, yes. No, I'm saying that the fact that phonons, so maybe I should go on because I'm not, but the fact that phonons non-linearly serve as Goldstone bosons for many spacetime symmetries means that their dynamics is constrained, their dynamics are constrained by all these spacetime symmetries. So if you want, if you were to write down the effective theory for phonons that non-linearly realize only shifts, you write down a more general Lagrangian than what you actually can realize in a real solid in nature. That's my point. And you can detect it in the leading order scattering amplitudes. Okay. Well, I mean, if you do an experiment in which you try to measure the phonon scattering, yes. I'm just so I agree that if you just try to eat up the solid and look at the effects of phonon scattering, probably it's a very small effect. But if you can actually do a scattering experiment involving phonons, why not? The leading order scattering amplitude has this property. You see what I mean? Okay. So, but I guess what I want to stress is that this has nothing to do with V over C effects, okay? So these are Lorentz relativistic effects, but there are order one relativistic effects associated with boost invariants even in the Galilei limit. Okay, anyway. So more precisely, what we've been doing in the past is defining, in a sense, condensed matter as a particular state in a Lorentz invariant theory, or Galilei invariant theory, if you want to take that limit, in which the full Poincaré group, which involves translations, rotations, and boosts, and perhaps internal symmetries, are broken down to translations, and for simplicity, let me also include rotations, okay? So for instance, if you want to talk about a lattice, a solid with a crystal structure, of course rotations are broken down to some diagonals, to some discrete subgroup. But for simplicity, let me talk about rotational invariant solids. And you see that here I'm putting bars and I'm putting nu. Okay, what do I mean by this? I mean that the residual translations and rotations can be, in general, linear combinations of the original translations and rotations appearing in Poincaré and internal symmetries. Internal shift symmetries, if you want, for translations, and internal SO3 symmetries for rotations. Now, this sounds crazy. Why on earth do I want to consider that? But it turns out that in the effective field theory language, this is actually how all media work, meaning we don't know of any medium which doesn't mix, upon breaking boosts, doesn't mix translations and rotation or rotations with internal symmetries, okay? So let me give you an example. And in fact, later, if I have time, I will try to fantasize about why we don't see any medium that just breaks boosts without mixing translations and rotations with internal symmetries. So let me give you the simplest example that we have been studying, and in fact, I'll also give you a number of applications about of this formalism. So Let's consider a solid or a fluid, okay? And here I just mean the infrared limit of the system in which I don't, even if I have a solid, I don't see the interparticle separation, so I don't see the lattice structure. I just see the medium, the continuous medium. If I have a fluid, I don't see the microscopic particles that make up the fluid, I just see the medium. And so I want to characterize the mechanical deformation, the formations of the medium, okay? So how do I do that? Well, so this is the medium. I erect a system of coordinates which are frozen in the medium, so they get deformed. If the medium gets deformed, they move if the medium moves. So I call them phi I. And then the configuration space of the medium is given by the mapping between the phi I's and the spatial coordinates at any given time. Okay? And so let's say, like in, so if you were to do this in analogy with the bosonic string, you'd say, well, I'll give you the physical coordinates as functions of moving coordinates and time. Okay? Now, it turns out that at least for us, we find it more convenient to use the inverse mapping. So at any given time, let me talk about phi I as a function of x. And the reason is the following, that now x and t behave very nicely under space-time symmetries. They make up a Lorentz vector, Lorentz position, x mu. And the phi I's are scalar fields. Okay? So the claim is that the configuration space of a solid or a fluid, isotropic solid or fluid, is given by a set of three scalar fields with certain symmetries. Okay? And the symmetries that you have to impose are obvious once you realize that at equilibrium, so if I take the medium and I bring it at rest in some homogeneous isotropic configuration, so I make it a cube like this, at equilibrium, the phi I's are aligned, or a convenient choice of my axis is that they are aligned with the physical coordinates. So I have phi I equals xi. So this certainly breaks boosts, which is what I want. I want the medium to break boosts. I want the medium to pick a frame. But it also breaks translations and rotations. Okay? And so how do you reconcile this with the apparent homogeneity and isotropy of the medium you want to describe? Well, you have to impose internal translations and internal rotations acting on the fields such that this background configuration, this equilibrium configuration, preserves diagonal combinations. Okay? This is forced on you if you try to write down the effective field theory for these volume element positions. Now, if you were to describe, so this system, this formalism also generalizes to anisotropic solids. If you were to describe some anisotropic solid with a lattice structure, instead of SO3 here, you want to put a discrete subgroup of SO3. Okay, so that upon breaking, you're left with a diagonal combination of the space-time SO3 and this diagonal, in this discrete subgroup. Now, what really differentiates a fluid from a solid is yet another symmetry, which in fact is infinite dimensional, is a much bigger symmetry. So a fluid, the dynamics of a fluid should be invariant under volume-preserving diffeomorphisms, internal diffeomorphisms, meaning that if, let's say, I start from this ground state we're talking about, and I start moving around volume elements without compressing them or dilating them, the fluid energy should not change. Whereas if I do that for a solid, so if I take a piece of wood, and I try to move volume elements around, even without compressing them, I feel very strong transverse stresses that want to bring them back to their position, to their rest position. So the claim is that fluid is invariant under these volume-preserving diffs. So you write down the effective Lagrangian for the system. And to lowest order in derivatives, it's pretty simple to guess what you get, because the shift invariance on the phis tell you that you should use derivatives for each phi. And then Lorentz, since the phis are scalars, Lorentz invariance tells you that the derivatives should contract like this. So you're left with this matrix, d mu phi I, d mu phi j. Let me write it here. I don't know if you all see it. Anyway, bij is d mu phi I, d mu phi j. And then internal SO3 and these volume-preserving diffs tell you that you should take the determinant. That's the only invariant you can construct at this order in derivatives, okay? So the action should be a generic function of the determinant, or it's technically more convenient to use the square root of the determinant. Simplifies the algebra, but of course it's a minor detail. Now, why do we have a generic function here? Well, it turns out that this generic function is associated with the equation of state of the fluid. So for given equation of state, which can be fairly generic for a fluid, If you give me the equation of state, I can give you the corresponding f and vice versa, okay? In particular, you can actually make this very precise. So if from here you derive the stress energy tensor, so you have the action, you derive the stress energy tensor, you get really the stress energy tensor of hydrodynamics, perfect fluid hydrodynamics. This is the lowest order in derivatives, so this is a perfect fluid. You get the right equations of motion. Upon identifying these hydrodynamical variables with these field theory variables, okay? So rho becomes f, p becomes this combination of f and derivatives. So in particular, an equation of state, which is an algebraic relation between rho and p, is a differential equation for f, first order, which apart from an integration constant determines f uniquely, okay? So that's why f is related to the equation of state. And then u mu turns out to be, here there's some epsilon contraction. So one epsilon is a spacetime epsilon, the other epsilon is an internal index epsilon. And it turns out that u mu you could have guessed purely in terms of geometrical considerations, no? Because the phi i's by definitions are commoving coordinates. So which means that they cannot change along the flow. So the flow is defined by this constraint, d mu phi I, u mu equals zero. For all eyes. So that combination is the only, this combination here with the right contractions is the only cross product, quote unquote, that is orthogonal to all the d mu phi i's. For u mu?
Yeah.
You keep going with the epsilons here. Keep going. Because in more dimensions, you have more commoving coordinates. The epsilon is bigger, so everything works out.
Well, that's
true, but it's strange. Well, but I have, so if in, but even the number of phi's is dimension dependent, so I don't see any.
Hmm?
There's two different apps. Yeah, so should, maybe it should be, okay, but my understanding is that the blackboard is not really visible. So, but there's an epsilon ijk, which contracts with the phi's, and there's an epsilon mu nu rho sigma, which contracts with the derivatives. And so they all scale in the same way when you scale the dimensions, no? And so. Yes, it's correct. But recall that the background is a background with constant first derivatives. So in a sense, d phi, in this power counting, d phi is order zero in derivatives. You see what I mean? Because on the background, it's constant. So the derivative expansion really has to do with derivatives acting on d phi and not with derivatives of phi. Why paradox? I mean, if you have five variables in five dimensions, it has to look different. Otherwise, how do you make it work? No. So I don't see any paradox. And as I'm saying, this is order zero in the derivative expansion in this power counting scheme. So in this sense, there's no real higher order paradox here. OK? Yes. So the incompressible limit is tricky. Okay, so let me come to the incompressible limit later. You want to talk? Let me come to that later. In two transparencies, okay? Okay. Okay. So if you want, it's not really f equal constant, no? Yes, but f is a function of b. So B is this determinant. So B is a measure of the compression level, okay? So it's not that F is equal constant. It's the incompressible limit is the statement that if you try to compress, so if you try to squeeze rho, P has to change by a lot. That's the physical incompressible limit, so which means that derivatives of F are big, okay? But let me come to the compressible limit in a second. Okay, and then you can look at excitations, okay? So you have the ground state that we talked about. You have some Gaussian excitations. By the way, I'm talking about classical physics here, okay? But I can use a QFT language. And in particular, if I expand the Lagrangian, I discover that only for the fluid, only the longitudinal guy has a gradient energy, okay? Which is what you expect, because you know that sound modes are longitudinal. They propagate at some given speed, which here has to do with derivatives of the Lagrangian, because I'm just expanding the Lagrangian. In hydrodynamics, it has to do with the derivative of P with respect to rho. but P and rho are related to the Lagrangian and its derivative, so everything works out, meaning this speed of sound square that I write down turns out to be exactly dp over d rho, okay? And the transverse guys, which don't feature a gradient energy, have a trivial dispersion relation. They have omega equals zero, okay? And if you think about it, you can identify them with the linearized progenitors of the vortices, meaning a vortex in constant rotation is not a propagating wave solution, okay? It's something that has essentially a zero frequency behavior because there is a constant, how do you say, angular velocity there, okay? So you can really make this analogy precise. But this also tells you that treating the transverse modes in perturbation theory is intrinsically a bad idea, okay? And in fact, with Ricardo and my former students, we tried at the quantum level, and we got nowhere, essentially. Vortices. You're talking about superfluids or ordinary fluids? We'll come to the dynamics of vortices. So the dynamics of vortices is incredibly counterintuitive. I'll come to that, okay? Yes. Yeah, exactly. So their dynamics, in a sense, is dominated by, they are overdamped waves. They are dominated by dissipative effects. At the perfect fluid level, so the lowest order in derivatives, they are pretty crazy. That's all I'm saying. Exactly. Which maybe it's okay, because probably it shouldn't be taken literally as a quantum theory. Okay? But let's forget for a second about the quantum theory. Let's just try to apply this ideology to actually classical fluids like water or other fluids and make some interesting predictions, okay? So we worked out a number of applications, so I won't have time to go through all of them. And so let me just talk about the first, okay, which is essentially the most recent applications we've come up with my former student Solomon, was here until yesterday, but yet to leave. So what's the idea? The idea is to go close to the incompressible limit, okay, which corresponds to the following statement. So first of all, incompressibility for a fluid is not an intrinsic property. It's a kinematic regime that is there for all fluids. It's a regime in which the fluid flow is much slower than the speed of sound. Okay, then you can check that if you just look at the equations of motion, or if you take our Lagrangian, you can check that for typical fluid flows that are much slower than the speed of sound, the fluid is nearly incompressible, meaning that it's difficult to excite sound waves, to excite compressional modes. And and the reason is very simple. So if I move my hand through air very slowly, it's much more convenient for air to displace itself around my hand than to compress in front of it. So that's the reason, okay? And so we can treat, since sound waves are difficult to excite, you can treat them perturbatively in perturbation theory. As we said, vortices, probably it's a bad idea to treat them perturbatively. In fact, we know that. There's turbulence, there's all sorts of effects associated with vorticity. So vorticity is intrinsically a non-linear degree of freedom in a fluid. But in this particular case, compressional modes can be dealt with in perturbation theory. So in a sense, we are taking the incompressible limit, not to the limit, but we are trying to do systematic corrections to the incompressible limit here, okay? In which we work at lowest order, so at, in perturbation theory in V over CS. And in certain cases, you can even integrate them out and work out the effects on the vortex dynamics. So since I don't have much time, let me skip the technical details, but it's fairly simple. So we have the Lagrangian for generic configurations of the fluid. We decompose the fluid into volume-preserving degrees of freedom. These are the vortices, and into compressional degrees of freedom. We expand the Lagrangian in these compressional degrees of freedom. Let me call them psi. Okay, so V0 is the velocity field associated with the volume-preserving diffeomorphisms, with the volume-preserving configurations, and psi is the compressional mode. So we have a free Lagrangian for the compressional modes. We have interactions, which are self-interactions of the compressional mode with itself, and interactions with the background fluid flow. And we are not able to solve for the dynamics of vortices in general, so let me take that as a given, meaning someone just hands you the time evolution of the vortices, or if you have turbulence, let's say the statistical correlators of turbulence. And then you can compute things in perturbation theory. You can compute observables involving sound. So for instance, you can compute the sound emission by some turbulent mass here, okay? So suppose you have some turbulent region, you want to measure how much sound comes out of it. Well, in field theory language, this is an imaginary part of a very simple diagram. In fact, here this is misleading, so I'm not treating the vortices here as propagating degrees of freedom. I'm taking them as external sources, as I said. So this is just a single propagator. The imaginary part comes from the I epsilon in the propagator and nothing else. And you can compute the power emitted. And you discovered that you've been scooped by 60 years. Okay? But we get the relativistic effects for free. And now by relativistic, I really mean V over C squared. Okay? And these are relativistic. In fact, sorry, I don't mean V over C squared. I mean CS over C squared, CS squared over C squared, meaning that these are relativistic effects associated with the equation of state of the fluid. So if I have an equation of state which is very relativistic, so let's say a very relativistic, very hot plasma, okay, in which the speed of sound is close to the speed of light, then these effects are of the same order as the leading non-relativistic effect computed by Light Hill, okay? I should also say that this ideology was inspired by essentially the same ideology that Goldberger and Rothstein applied to emission and other effects associated with gravitational waves in binary systems, okay? So then you can keep going. For instance, you can compute the scattering of sound waves by turbulent motion, by a turbulent region. This is supposed to be, according to these people, a very interesting probe of turbulence itself, meaning if you look at the scattering of ultrasounds by turbulence, you can measure very precisely turbulent correlators. And in our Lagrangian, so there's many potential interactions that matter here, but you realize by power counting, essentially, that this is the leading interaction. So it's a single vertex. It's trivial to compute it. Once again, we reproduce the result, scooped by many decades again, but again with relativistic corrections, okay? This V tilde, delta K, is nothing but the Fourier transform of the velocity of the turbulent velocity field computed at the momentum transfer, okay? So if you measure this this cross section, you know this Fourier transform. Yes? Well, it can be. So it can be really stationary in the sense that you have a very clean vortex solution like this, in which case, again, we do, it doesn't meet. But if you have turbulence, it's stationary only in a statistical sense. So there's a lot of... Yes, 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 absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yes. Yes. That's the ideology, okay? So for instance, suppose that you want to measure the statistical properties of a turbulent region. Yes. But it can be a generic vortex solution. So turbulence may be simpler, quote unquote, because it's some sort of statistical equilibrium configuration, or it can be a very clean vortex configuration. No, but sorry. Turbulence, so the interesting, if you want, the so-called energy cascade in turbulence goes from very large scales to very small scales. At very small scales, you dissipate via viscosity, but there is this whole inertial range of scales in which viscosity is essentially unimportant. So the transfer of energy doesn't have to do with viscosity. No, but that's... But I'm saying viscosity only acts at very low scales. So in a sense, it's not relevant to determine the statistical properties of the inertial range. For instance, to derive the Kolmogorov spectrum, you don't use, viscosity doesn't enter in the inertial range. But even if you don't take the limit of zero viscosity, I'm saying, so viscosity is a higher derivative, is associated with a higher derivative correction to perfect fluid dynamics. If you work at scales that are much bigger than the relevant cutoff scale, you can just neglect it. Then I agree with you that overall, in terms of energy balance, if you keep steering, that energy has to go somewhere. But I'm saying to derive the bulk of the dynamics in the inertial range, you don't need viscosity. Yes, well, here I'm not even doing that. Here I'm just saying, okay, this could be turbulence, this could be a generic vortex, just give me this Fourier transform. Or, put another way, if you measure this cross-section, you know this Fourier transform. That's what I'm saying. I'm not trying to solve for the dynamics of the vortices, if that's what you're asking. Okay, but these were computations that were already done somewhere. So this is a more interesting computation from my viewpoint. So, because here you really see the power of effective field theory. So, you're saying, okay, I have vortices, I have sound modes. Sound modes are gapless. They can be exchanged. They can travel, okay? They have to mediate a long-range interaction. So there's no way out. So the field theory ideology tells you that there must be a long-range interaction mediated by sound, okay? And it's, I mean, it's immediate to compute it, okay? So this is the lowest order diagram. I mean, just for fun, my student, for fun, it was not much fun for him, but he computed the next to leading order, and he has a paper coming out at some point, I think. But the leading order diagram is already non-zero, so that's probably what you should focus on. And apart from some tensor structure, which we have it, I mean, we have all the pi's, et cetera, the result is the following. So it's a 1 over R cube potential energy. The q's are essentially some sort of multiple moments of the velocity field for each vortex, okay? And then the effect, so for instance, with respect to the average kinetic energy of the two vortices, the effect is suppressed by powers of V over Cs and by powers of the size of the vortices over R, okay? And so we didn't know whether this was useful. So first of all, we have never heard of this question, let alone the answer, okay? So we couldn't find it in the literature. It's not probably a natural question you want to ask in hydrodynamics, but in field theory, it's a very natural question. So we didn't know whether it's useful, whether it's detectable in any system, whether it was known. Now, at the same time, Slava, so we have the luck of being friends with Slava, and Slava told us that a friend of his, Professor William Irvine at the University of Chicago, does experiments in fluids, okay? So we contacted him, and he told us, I don't know, okay? So at least he didn't know about this effect. And then we started talking about it with him, whether he can check this effect, okay? And we got incredibly confused, okay? Because how do you check? Well, you're saying, look, I have a potential, there's going to be a force. It turns out that that's not true, okay? In the following sense, there's no obvious sense in which you can talk about forces acting on vortices. So let me give you the following example. So the simple vortex configurations you can imagine, so you can even visualize, are vortex lines. So these are, in water, let's say they exist in water. They are almost singular. Of course, at some point, the singularity is resolved. But let's take the singular limit in which you have a line where vorticity is concentrated. Everywhere else, the velocity field is curl-free. And so the velocity field rotates along the line like this, like 1 over R, essentially. It's like a magnetic field of a line current, okay? Now, precisely because of this analogy, this relation between vorticity and velocity being the same as the relation between current and magnetic field in magnetostatics, the velocity field everywhere is given by a Biot-Savart integral, where gamma is the circulation about the line. I'm talking about the incompressible limit now. So for simplicity, let's first talk about the incompressible limit. And so now, also, it turns out that because of Kelvin's theorem, which is a very powerful vorticity conservation theorem in hydrodynamics, you can actually evaluate this velocity field at the line itself. It's generically logarithmically divergent, but that's fine. The line is resolved. It has a finite thickness, okay? So if you evaluate this velocity field at the line itself, this gives you the velocity, the instantaneous velocity of that line element. So you see that now you have a first order equation of motion. The line elements have a velocity which is completely determined by the geometry. There's no integration constant for the velocity. There's no initial condition for the velocity. You don't have forces. The equation of motion is not of the form acceleration equals something, is velocity equals something. So even if you take the derivative of this potential, you don't know what to do with it. Okay, so there's no room for forces. So these are unlike, let's say, strings in empty space, either fundamental strings or cosmic strings or fundamental strings obey second order equation of motion. They're just some sort of dignified point particle with some extra coordinate, but they obey standard equations of motion. These are not dignified point particles. These are completely different objects, okay? So before I tell you what we did with it, I'm running out of time. Yes. This thing, because this is like magnetostatics. So I have the vorticity is the curl of V, and in the compressible limit I have the divergence of V zero. So this is like magnetostatics. Yes, the velocity of the liquid, but if you apply Kelvin's theorem to a tiny loop surrounding the line itself, it turns out that has to be the velocity at which also the line moves. There's no independent motion, so coming back to Arkady's question, there's no independent motion between vortices and the underlying fluid. Vortices flow with the fluid, which is unlike anything that happens in free space, okay? So vortices are dragged by the surrounding fluid. There's no way out. Okay? So before I tell you what we did, let me just convince you that these are interesting systems, okay? So these vortex lines and their curled up version, the vortex rings, are really, people study them. So in particular, our friend William Irvine at Chicago. So these are videos from his group, okay? So this is a very exotic fluid known as water at room temperature and atmospheric pressure, okay? These are actual data, so these are not simulations. So in the first one, they're pushing water through the hole, through this hole, and they sprinkle tiny water bubbles. And because of the pressure gradients, the water bubble flow to the core of the vortex line. So they really act as a tracer of the vortex line without affecting much the dynamics of the vortex line. Okay, so that's a vortex ring. Then they have a 3D printer, so they play with it. They generate hydrofoils, and they just pull them through water, and again sprinkle water bubbles, and they see what happens. So for instance, this is a vortex ring with some excitation on it. These excitations are called Kelvin waves, okay? Notice that these are fully three-dimensional data, meaning that they have a very high-frequency laser tomography scanner so that they have three-dimensional video that they can rotate in real time at will, okay? They're interested in topology, so they're able to knot vortex lines on themselves. They were the first ones to do this, no? I think 2 years ago or 1 year ago. And these are two vortex rings knotted with each other. So apart from our friend Irvine, there's other groups, other mammals in particular, which play with vortex ring. So dolphins are known to just teach it. Sorry for the advertisement. I don't know how to avoid that. I downloaded the video before, but now it's showing again. I'm sorry about that. TurboTax. So dolphins are known to teach each other how to blow, certain dolphins are to blow vortex rings. So sorry, the quality of the video is not good. So in fact, I asked for higher quality video to some people. And you see, they're very stable objects, meaning they live for tens of seconds. And in fact, they are able to sort of play with, the dolphins are able to play with them and take out smaller pieces and create smaller vortices. And so I got in contact with the person in Italy who manages dolphins, who are able to do these things. And I asked him for high quality footage. And I asked him whether he can train them to actually do scattering experiments. And no, it's true. And he told me, this is interesting, I have to talk with my scientific staff. So maybe, I mean, of course, so Irvine's experiments are much more precise, but this is much more fun, so. This guy is trying to go inside now, to fit inside, yeah. Anyway, so a lot of experimental activity. And so the question is, okay, so can we understand them? So their dynamics is really different from ordinary objects in free space, okay? So can we understand them? Well, again, so for instance, can we understand the effect of our potential? Well, what do we do with the potential? You add it to the Lagrangian. So first, let's write down a zero order Lagrangian for them, okay? So this is the effective field theory for these vortex lines. So I'm parameterizing their position x as a function of a parameter along the line and of time. So very pragmatically, before we even talk about symmetries, derivative expansion, et cetera, very pragmatically, we have to reproduce this equation of motion. So it's a first order differential equation in time derivative, so the kinetic energy has to involve one time derivative. It has a non-local right-hand side, so there should be a non-local term in the action. Okay, turns out that this is the action that reproduces the equation of motion and the right energy, the right energetics of the vortex. Okay, so in principle, yes. In practice, we don't know how to do it efficiently. I mean, it seems to me a very hard technical problem. So let me tell you why we believe this action. Well, it obeys the, it should be, but I don't know exactly how to do it, how to really do it. I mean, I can write down maybe formally a path integral, but I'm not sure how to carry out the computation. But let me convince you that, in fact, this is motivated by symmetry. Apart from reproducing the right equation of motion, this is motivated by symmetry. So first of all, okay, we have an action, we are happy because we like effective field theories, blah, 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 but there's a non-local term. So, and I personally have zero intuition about non-local terms. It's a purely spatial non-local interaction. Still, it's non-local. So, for instance, I don't know what the rules are. So what's the power counting, what are the power counting rules, et cetera? Is there a derivative expansion for non-local terms, et cetera? But, I mean, this is fake, no? Because it's a 1 over R non-local interaction, so we know exactly what to do. So there's an auxiliary field, which we can introduce. Let's call it A, like a vector potential, which couples to this current, and it has a purely spatial gradient energy. Remember that this is the incompressible limit, so it's fine to have instantaneous. Formally, it's fine to have instantaneous propagation. And you can, if you integrate out A, you recover exactly this. Okay? Now notice that this statement is true even at the quantum level, so because A appears at most quadratically. So in the path integral, you can really do this integrating out exactly, which means that if you want to apply the same formalism to superfluids, in fact, for superfluids, the dynamics of vortex lines is identical, then you can do it. So you can really do this, you can push it at the quantum level. And so now the analogy with with the magnetostatics is complete, because this is nothing but the vector potential of magnetostatics. We call it the hydrophoton, okay? And so the velocity field in particular turns out to be the curl of the vector potential of the hydrophoton, and there is a perfect dictionary between incompressible hydrodynamics and magnetostatics, with the difference that the action of magnetic fields on currents goes through the Lorentz force. Here, it's much, is very different, okay? Because now the analog of the magnetic field, which is nothing but the velocity field, is instantaneously the propagation velocity of a given volume element, okay? So it's a very different effect. But as far as computing the magnetic field associated with a given current distribution goes, this is identical. We can also take the point particle limit, okay? So suppose we want to work, so we ask the dolphins to create very small vortex rings, okay? And we want to work in a multiple expansion for these vortex rings. So we go to the point particle limit and then we want to talk about multiples. And then you also there, you realize that the dynamics of these point particles is super confusing, because now mu here is some sort of is the analog of the magnetic moment. So for a given ring with orientation n and radius r, mu is n r squared. And in the point particle limit, turns out that the degrees of freedom I have to keep are the position of the vortex ring and both the orientation and r. So I really have to keep two vectors as degrees of freedom, x and mu. For each vortex ring, I have x and mu. And so I have this super funny kinetic energy, which comes just from taking the point particle limit of that funny kinetic energy I was telling you about. And then I have a dipole interaction with the hydrophoton, because, again, it's just magnetostatics and nothing else. And then I have the kinetic energy of the hydrophoton. Or if you want, if you just want to take into compute how these vortex rings interact with each other, integrate out the hydrophoton, you get a dipole-dipole interaction. And you get this term, which comes from integrating out the short distance contribution of the hydrophoton. So this is some sort of self-energy that is there for each vortex ring. And it tells you, in particular, that each vortex ring moves at a speed which is essentially, which goes like 1/r times some log. And there's UV cutoff, which is the thickness of the ring, okay, of the line. So once again, these are first order equations of motion, meaning that the velocity is completely determined by the geometry and nothing else. There's no independent initial condition. So in particular, even the conservation laws look locally funny. The conserved momentum associated with translations is the sum of dipole moments. That's conserved. Okay. Angular momentum is again x cross the dipole moment. And the energy, since this is linear order in time derivatives, the kinetic energy, in fact, does not contribute to the energy, does not contribute to the Hamiltonian. So the conserved Hamiltonian is a purely static, quote unquote, Hamiltonian. It looks like a potential. Okay? And then you can compute certain things. So for instance, if you reintroduce sound, so in the first part of my talk, I told you how to couple incompressible motion to sound. So let's reintroduce it. So we have the Lagrangian. So in this language, now the sound field couples to the hydrophoton, okay, from our original Lagrangian. And so in an apparently complicated scattering event in which you have two vortex rings scattering off each other, and there's going to be some compressional mess going on, and you want to understand how much of this compressional mess makes it to infinity. Well, in Feynman diagrams, it's a super simple Feynman diagram. You can compute it. I'm putting the factors here just to show that the computation is really straightforward. It's a tiny power emitted, but I was talking yesterday actually with this person, William Irvine, and he's not sure exactly about the sensitivity of his microphones, but I convinced him to try to stick a microphone in the water and see what happens. So maybe we're going to measure this. Let me just mention some work in progress. I had two more topics to talk about. I won't have time, but let me at least mention this. So we want to push this to the quantum level, okay? So in particular, everything I've said for vortex lines applies to liquid helium as well, okay? In fact, in liquid helium, vortex lines, generically in a superfluid, vortex lines are the only allowed vortex configurations, and they're truly quantum objects there, but we can take our effective field theory and just quantize it. And in liquid helium, there is this funny spectrum that people talk about. I'm not even sure exactly what they mean, but the claim is the following. So that there is only one branch of elementary excitations, by which I operationally think they mean that if you do, for instance, neutron scattering experiments, and you look at the momentum transfer as a function of the energy transfer, and you try to isolate the single particle poles there rather than some continuum, then you just find one curve, okay? So there's one curve that extends from very low momenta all the way to atomic size momenta, okay? And this curve is linear at low momenta, and these are the phonons, and at some point there's a bump and there's a minimum. And the excitations close to the minimum are called the rotons, okay? They're gapped, and they're super weird, so in particular, notice that you have a minimum at finite momentum, which means that if you sit right at the minimum, you have an excitation with finite momentum, which stays there. The group velocity is zero. In fact, if you move to the left of the minimum, you have momentum in that direction and group velocity in the other direction. And these are experimentally tested facts, meaning that there are experiments in which you propagate an excitation from here to here, and when it hits an atom here, the atom goes the other way. And so, now, it turns out, in fact, the interpretation is due to Feynman, that these rotons have some features that make them look like microscopic vortex rings, okay? So Feynman was able to write down an ansatz for the wave function, really, of the helium atoms, in which the roton looks like some sort of toroidal flow. But, of course, it's atomic size, so it's not obvious what to make of it, okay? Because hydrodynamic description breaks down at these sizes. And so what we want to do, so we are not sure exactly how far we can push this idea, but what we want to do is, well, we have an action for vortex rings and for phonons coupled to these vortex rings. And so let's try to see, to compute, for instance, virtual effects, so quantum effects associated with virtual phonons. So for instance, the self-energy associated with a cloud of virtual phonons about a very small vortex ring. Now, of course, the vortex ring is not inside the effective field theory of the of the phonons, because it's a, in liquid helium it's really a microscopic object, but maybe we can treat it as a point particle coupled to light fields, pretty much like, I don't know, heavy quark effective theory. So we are not sure exactly how far we can go, but this could be an interesting handle on the Roton problem. So I understand that apart from these answers by Feynman, people don't know much about Roton. So this could really be some trivial progress in the physics of liquid helium. I had a lot more to say. Let me just say this. So we've been talking about fluids and solids in this very cumbersome way. We start from Poincaré, internal symmetries, we break down to some diagonal subgroups. But in fact, physically, when we talk about fluids, we say, okay, there's a frame, but translations and rotations are not broken. So physical observables, like, I don't know, the stress energy tensor, stuff like this, don't break rotation. So do we really need all this extra machinery? Can't we just break boosts? So what happens if we try to write down the effective field theory for the Goldstones associated with just the breaking of boosts? Okay, what do we get? So for instance, a system, suppose you're given a quantum field theory in which there is a vector operator, and there is a state in which the vector operator takes an expectation value like this, aligned with the time direction, but nothing else, meaning there's no order parameters that break translations and rotations. What's the effective field theory for the Goldstones? Now it turns out that this is not a solid or a fluid. This we call a framid. It's an hypothetical medium, and in fact we are puzzled why it's not there, but this is the simplest way in which nature should break boosts, and why it doesn't do it this way, it's a puzzle, okay? But we call it a framid because this is a system which you're just picking a frame, and you're never picking positions for volume elements, unlike a fluid or a solid. Now it turns out that if you write down the effective field theory for the Goldstones, I won't bore you with the detail, and you ask, okay, how do I check whether it's the same as a fluid or a solid? Well, you just compute a physical observable, like a scattering amplitude. So the scattering amplitude of Goldstones for solids or fluids go like e to the fourth, the 2 to 2 scattering amplitude. It's just a consequence of the fact that the Goldstones have to nonlinearly realize at least an abelian subgroup, which was this broken shift, okay? And so once you start having shifts, each Goldstone comes with a derivative. Whereas these Goldstones for the framid don't have any abelian subgroup to nonlinearly realize. They only have to nonlinearly realize boosts, which is non-abelian. So it's pretty much like pions. And with pions, you know that the scattering amplitude can go like E squared. This is just power counting. Could there be cancellations that magically make these two systems the same? So you actually compute the scattering amplitude. And the answer is no, meaning that the scattering amplitude for the framid is completely determined in terms of parameters that appear already at the quadratic level in the Goldstone Lagrangian, and as long as the quadratic level Goldstone Lagrangian is non-degenerate, so as long as these phonons have standard dispersion laws, this scattering amplitude is non-zero. So the framid is really a very different object, and it's not obvious why it doesn't exist in nature, so we had a number of guesses, and for the moment, I would say the most promising guess is the following. If you compute the stress energy tensor at equilibrium, it is exactly zero. Or if you include a cosmological constant, it takes the form of a cosmological constant. So a framid, if it exists, it's an intrinsically relativistic system. So you cannot build it in a lab with atoms. You have to look for it in outer space, probably. Okay. But I think it's an interesting question. This is the simplest way in which you could break boosts. And it's not obvious why we don't experience it. I had more material, but let me stop here. So my conclusions are that if you insist, at least for certain questions, if you insist on space-time symmetries, even for condensed matter systems, which apparently have nothing to do with space-time symmetries, you can get a lot of mileage. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for a nice talk. Are there any questions or comments?
So you said that the framid is an intrinsically relativistic system. So suppose I take a relativistic CFT with a conserved current and I deform it with a chemical potential.
Yes.
I used to think like if I had free fermions, I'd get a Fermi liquid. But should I be thinking of that as a framid or?
No, I don't know. So that's an interesting question. So for instance, another standard case in which you do the same, let's say you do it with bosons, you get a superfluid.
That's right.
Which is a system which in this language breaks not only boosts, but if you want, it also breaks time translations in this language in the following sense that, sorry, is there an eraser? Can we raise this a little? Thank you. Thank you very much. So in this language, you see, so you're saying, let's take your system with Hamiltonian H. Let's put a finite chemical potential, okay, and let's look for a state which minimizes this. Let me call it mu. Mm-hmm. So the ground state, now it's finite chemical potential, is a state that minimizes this new Hamiltonian. Now, and so you could say, okay, so this looks promising because I know that J mu is going to have now a non-trivial expectation value, so it looks like I'm going in the right direction. But at least for superfluids, what happens is that really at zero temperature in the quantum phase, you break Q. When you try to do this, you break Q. The moment you break Q, you have to break H. Because breaking Q means that the ground state is not an eigenstate of Q, but it's an eigenstate of this combination. So it means that it cannot be an eigenstate of H either. So a superfluid is a system in my classification in which you break time translations and an internal charge down to the diagonal combination P0 minus mu Q. So it's not a framed. And in fact, scattering amplitudes in superfluids go like e to the fourth. Now, in the Fermi liquid, it's not trivial because there I don't know the characterization, how to characterize the Goldstone bosons. No, because in a Fermi liquid, I usually don't. Anyway, maybe we can discuss about it. But I mean, you have to keep track of. So my whole ideology here is that you have to keep track of Lorentz invariance at every step. Okay, so maybe if we do the Fermi liquid with Lorentz invariance, maybe we understand what's going on there. But at least for superfluids, it doesn't turn out to be frame. It turns out to be something else. You break some translations, which are time translations, instead of just generating a vector order parameter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll get to you.
So how did the equations that you get differ from those of ordinary relativistic
hydrodynamics?
Fluid mechanics, yeah.
They're identical. Okay. This is just a reorganization of those equations. At the classical level, this is just, for certain questions, an efficient way to solve those equations in perturbation theory.
But you said that you started off from this formulation which was explicitly relativistic, and this gave you some way of calculating the coefficients somehow.
No. Sorry. This is effective field theory. So the coefficients are supposed to be given by experiments. What this gives you is, if you want, a systematic organizational tool to keep track of what's forced upon you just because of symmetries. So the consequences of symmetries in this language are manifest. That's all
I'm
saying.
And the other question was, when you were talking about the vortices, that was all non-relativistic.
Yes, right? I took, for simplicity, I took the non-relativistic case. Non-relativistic in the sense of Galilei versus Lorentz, not
yes,
in the sense
yeah,
that...
Yes. Galileans.
Yes, I took that limit simply because in the experiments, so in this water tank that our
with
friends
the,
has,
yes.
they're dealing with water.
Yeah,
you could do the relativistic version.
There can be astrophysical applications,
yes.
Perhaps, where they are?
Yeah, exactly. So we are working on the relativistic generalization. Because, for instance, in pulsars, apparently, the dynamics of at least one of the claims or guesses is that for certain pulsars, the dynamics of the star as a whole is for some dramatic events like earthquakes, it's dominated by vortex lines in the neutron superfluid that are pulling on the crust, and at some point they break it. And so, yes, this could have interesting applications there, potentially, yeah.
More questions?
I wonder, you know, if you don't have your presence scale of effective action for those compounds, but then, okay, let's compare this in carbon, random, or pi, right?
Yes.
So the series of expansion, you know, in Marmion, right?
Yes. Yes.
And my question was that what you are talking about is a liquid dome, right? So people ask you, you know, about what is the possible,
very good. So Very good. So for classical hydrodynamics, at next order, you hit dissipation. So you have to deal with dissipation before you start talking about higher derivative effects. And so we did something along those lines, but we're still confused about how to do it systematically. But at least at first order in everything, in particular in the Goldstones themselves. So in this paper, where is it? Sorry. Here, dissipative hydrodynamics. In this paper, we show how to deal with dissipation by coupling the Goldstones to some other sector, which somehow we characterize as living in the fluid. So physically, dissipation is due to the fact that you have some thermal bath, which makes up the fluid. And in this thermal bath, there are other excitations which are not keeping track of, which are not the Goldstones. And so you dissipate into those. And we were able to model that coupling in a fairly model-independent way, meaning just in terms of symmetries, derivative expansion, etc. So we show that if you take this philosophy, you can reproduce, you can rederive, actually, the famous Kubo relations, which relate viscosity coefficients to correlators, for instance, of the stress tensor. But we're still confused about how to do it systematically. But so I would say that before talking about higher derivative effects, you really have to talk about dissipation. Whereas in superfluids, at zero temperature, there's no dissipation, so you can push the philosophy further. And yes, you can write down, in terms of symmetries, higher derivative effects. Yes.
More questions?
Forgive my ignorance. These vortex rings, these rotons and superfluids, so you're saying they have atomic scale? So if you go just a little bit higher, then the whole story ends, this line that you drew. So it doesn't extend much higher.
Exactly.
Right? Or rather, you enter, I mean,
the experimentalists are not particularly, where is the line? Sorry.
What is their width of these degrees of freedom? Do they
Very
have
good.
Finite
so
width?
They are. So I couldn't find that information in the literature, but it seems to me that if you look at the line, sorry, where is the line? You can prove that they are exactly stable. And the reason is that if you try to draw arrows, okay, that adapt to the right momentum, and you take into account the right energy, you see that given the shape of this line, the fact that there is a minimum, if you start close to the minimum, there's no way you can decay into a combination of guys that are here. So I think they are exactly stable, even though I couldn't find this information in the literature. But coming back to your original question, so I'm not sure the experimentalists are very worried by where the line stops, because they're just doing neutron scattering experiments. They measure the momentum transfer, they measure the energy transfer. They don't want to know anything about effective field theory, etc. They're just giving you some kinematical information about these excitations. So these excitations, I mean, you expect in a superfluid also to have microscopic excitations, no? And
if you go high, you should see the helium atoms, right?
Yes, exactly.
So where are they in this plot? Like factor
well,
two higher
mean,
or
so
factor
I think all of these
higher?
Excitations at some level, when you go to those sizes are really dressed helium atoms at some level, no? But I don't think you ever see a single helium atom, because the interparticle separation is of order of the size. So somehow, all these excitations are collective at some level, even at very high momenta, I think.
Well, at very high momenta, it would be like deep inelastic scattering. You should kick out a single helium atom.
Yeah, maybe at that level. Is that right? Yeah, maybe. But kick out, but this is an infinite system, no? So this, in first approximation, meaning, If you exclude boundary effects, you don't kick out, you push. And when this guy moves, it goes with some cloud, I think. I'm not an expert. But I'm saying, operationally, that's what they give you. They tell you, look, I'm doing these experiments, and this is the line. And even here, you're already at atomic size. So in a sense, these are really dressed helium atoms, I think.
More comments? Okay, if not, let's hang the speaker.
Okay, if you couple your framage to gravity, isn't that what gives you this relativistic version of Milgram's theory, modified Newtonian dynamics?
I think it gives you Ted Jacobson's Einstein ether. Is it the same?
It might be this. I'm not sure. But
I think it gives you the Einstein ether.
But your attitude was that this is a beautiful theory that nature should use. So
I think so. Yes. I think so. That's our attitude. Do you agree?
So you're saying we shouldn't look for dark matter?
No, I'm not saying that this is something going on in cosmology. I'm just saying that purely at the level of quantum field theory, symmetry breaking patterns, etc., this is the simplest way to break Lorentz. So it's sort of funny that it's not realized.
Okay, so let's thank the speaker and reconvene in 30 minutes.